Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie covering Kingston City Council's decision to sell a tract of land to build a multi-sport complex at St. Lawrence Business Park.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
At their meeting last week, Council voted unanimously to sell 4.4 acres at St. Lawrence Business Park for the purpose of building a multi-sport complex. The land adjacent to the existing John Matchin soccer fields is being sold to Kingston Multisport Investment Group to build a 65,000-square-foot indoor facility. The proposed development consists of one full-size soccer field that can be divided into four mini-fields. Additionally, the facility will include a sports clinic, physiotherapy offices, changing rooms, a multipurpose room, and a snack bar, among other amenities. This decision comes in the middle of ongoing discussions regarding the proposed soccer stadium at the Memorial Center, an issue that split the community earlier this winter and will be returning to council for a final decision in March. Local soccer coach and Kingston and District Sports Hall of Fame member Victor Mendez is one of the private investors behind the proposal and spoke to their vision before council.
This project was born of a discussion over a dire lack of local indoor facilities suitable for grass or turf sports during our Canadian late fall and winter months. To put things into perspective, there are probably about 2,000 to 2,500 youth hockey players in Kingston. They are serviced by 9 indoor ice pads and 16 outdoor rinks. All are run by the city except for Constantine at RMC. Several of the indoor rinks remain open in the summertime. A conservative estimate of youth soccer players in the city is about 7,500. This does not even take into account the other sports like ultimate frisbee, football, baseball, etc., played by youth and active young adults. During the fall and winter months, there are zero indoor turf facilities run by the city. We decided we should do our part to help rectify the situation by building a facility to give active Kingstonians access to playing their sport of choice year-round. Finally, our vision is to create a hub to bring our community together, unite our athletes by giving them a place to gather to help them achieve their full potential.
When asked by Councillor Lisa Osanek, Mendez estimated that the cost to rent the entire field would land around $1,000 an hour, with the option of renting sections of the field at a lower rate. Tim Scott, president of the Kingston United Soccer Club, also spoke before council in support of the proposal.
I can't say enough how enthusiastic we are to support the proposal to put an indoor multi-sport facility near Machin Park. It's absolutely essential for our club, for our programs. For the last few years, there's been a real shortage of indoor turf in Kingston. We've had to switch to using gyms, which is not ideal for soccer. And our high performance teams that play in that provincial league have had to travel to Belleville.
Councillor Osanek had the following short comment on the proposal.
I am so overjoyed with this proposal for Highway 15.
Community engagement was conducted throughout fall 2024, including online and in-person opportunities. The last 37 pages of the 49-page report presented to council were filled with comments received from community members. Online engagement yielded 267 comments taking a stance, with 71% expressing support for the proposal, while 29% were against the proposal. Many of the concerns revolved around the loss of open green space and the selling of public land to private investors. The motion passed unanimously without further discussion amongst councillors. If all goes according to plan, Kingstonians can expect the facility to be up and running in late 2026. This has been Christina Lori with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about the concerns related to the Bridge Street West development in Greater Napanee.
Thank you, Jesse. At the regular meeting of the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee on Tuesday, February 25th, two public meetings were on the agenda to discuss the development of the west end of the town. First up was a presentation by RFA planning consultant Dale Egan on behalf of Stikos Homes, which has plans for a further subdivision development in the Westbridge Estates area. Stikos applications seek approval to construct 19 single detached dwellings and 24 semi-detached units for 43 dwelling units total. The development would connect to Bridge Street West and Sierra Drive. A stormwater management pond would be constructed at the south end of the development, and parkland would be dedicated to the town at the south end of the lands to provide a connection to Cherrywood Parkway parkland area. Councillor Dave Pennell noted concerns from his ward constituents regarding traffic and speeding in the area. Pennell was assured that these concerns would be addressed with the installation of a roundabout and new traffic lights in the area. The other presentation was given by Eric Baez on behalf of Bash Developments. The subject application proposes to create a residential subdivision on the 16.4-hectare site with 138 single-detached dwellings, 124 townhouse dwellings, and mixed-use buildings consisting of 10 live-work units. The subdivision would include the creation of new public roads, park space, and stormwater management ponds. A question was raised about the impact that this development could have on some at-risk wildlife species in the area, namely barn owls, bobolinks, and meadowlarks. Baez explained that as per provincial regulations, a similar habitat for the impacted species would be provided nearby. The meeting concluded with Mayor Terry Richardson thanking all parties involved for their time and contributions, noting that all comments and concerns would be considered thoughtfully. Meetings of the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee can be viewed virtually or watched afterward on the Napanee Town Council YouTube channel or attended in person in Council Chambers at Napanee Town Hall, 124 John Street. Further information about Council meetings, including agendas and reports, is available on the Town's website. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a sports report covering an eventful and historic weekend for Queen's University.
Thank you, Dinah. It was an eventful weekend for Queen's athletics and recreation, with several playoff games being hosted on campus. But for all the excitement at the Athletics and Recreation Center, the weekend began with historic news about 10 minutes away on West Campus. On Friday, February 28th, the CFL's Ottawa Redblacks announced that they will be holding their annual spring training camp at Richardson Memorial Stadium. This will be the first time in Redblacks history that the team's training camp takes place outside of Ottawa. Head football coach Steve Snyder said that, quote, bringing the CFL to Kingston and to Queens will make for an exciting spring of football. He continued, noting that having a CFL training camp operate out of team facilities is, quote, a really special opportunity for Queens student athletes, coaches, and community members. The Red Blacks will hit the field at Richardson Stadium for the first time on Sunday, May 11th, with all training camp practices open to the public. Practice times will be announced on a weekly basis at the beginning of camp. In collaboration with Queen's Athletics and Recreation and Tourism Kingston, Ottawa will also host a fan fest at Richardson Stadium on Saturday, May 17th. A historic Friday for Queens was capped off with a dominant victory on the ice. The Queens men's hockey team completed their sweep over the Ottawa Gigis in the OUA East semifinals with a dominant 7-3 victory. The top-ranked Concordia Stingers are the next stop for the Gales on their road to the 113th Queen's Cup. Speaking of provincial championships, on Saturday, March 1st, the reigning Wilson Cup champion, Queens Gales, continued their title defense with a gritty victory over the Ontario Tech Ridgebacks at home. The Gales started slow, struggling to find consistent offensive rhythm while the Ridgebacks built a small lead. The Gales trailed 31-28 at half. A slow first half was followed by a glacial third quarter, as the two teams combined to score just 20 total points. However, Queens put up 12 and Ontario Tech had 8, giving the Gales a one-point lead heading into the fourth quarter. Though the game was short on flair for the first three quarters, the fourth was absolutely electric at the arc. Both teams traded buckets as the lead swung back and forth throughout the quarter. It would be Kingston's own Lucas Sillis who would score the deciding basket and one layup to put the Gales up by two with just seconds remaining. A frantic final possession from Ontario Tech proved fruitless as the Gales scraped by 64-62. Queens will travel to Ottawa on March 8th to play the Gigi's for the Wilson Cup.
Thank you so much. And now over to LJR reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the appointment of a new fire chief in Greater Napanee.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. At their meeting this week, Greater Napanee Council named Sean Armstrong the new fire chief of the Greater Napanee Fire Department. Armstrong had been serving as the acting fire chief since April 2024 and officially assumed his new role on Wednesday. Armstrong provided council with his mandate letter at the meeting, highlighting the need to create predictable organizational behavior through standards, policies, and systems. He presented a set of fire protection service standards for all department programs and services, which council unanimously decided to receive and adopt. Armstrong has previously served as the fire chief for the city of Guelph and most recently for the city of Kingston. Armstrong spoke about the importance of fire service levels.
Fire service levels assist the fire department by ensuring that we're all focused and reaching towards the same goals. It's also important to understand what the training requirements are and having the right resources, staffing, and equipment to carry out those training requirements. And also giving the firefighters clarity in their role and allowing them to stay in their lane, which I've heard since my time here, and provide the services they need to provide in their positions they are serving in. And all of that helps in giving that empowerment to the firefighters to use their skills in the most professional way that they always use them in.
Armstrong talks about the work of the Greater Napanee Fire Department.
We do rescue and emergency services. We'll do entrapments from cars. We'll do technical rope rescue. We'll do other technical rescues. We do fire prevention. We do mandatory inspections. We do inspections upon complaint. We'll do real estate transfers. We'll do immediate threats to life. We're down ensuring that the community is safe in our public spaces. And serving as that, we also do public education and fire safety education. That includes our visits to the schools, ensuring that we have a smoke and CO alarm program. That is a legislative requirement when providing fire protection services through a fire department, and ensuring that people are aware of the need to have a functioning smoke alarm, smoke detector, and CO detector on each floor of their dwelling, and especially outside of the sleeping areas.
Armstrong noted the work the department is doing for the unhoused community in Greater Napanee.
We have been working with Bylaw and the firefighters to provide information and materials to our people that are unhoused in our community and making sure they're as safe as they can be. We've noticed last year, and we anticipate it happening again, that we'll be responding to fires in public spaces. We've worked with the clerk's office and all of the senior leadership team to address this in a way that's incrementally helpful. And we'll continue to keep our eye on and monitor that. And that is a service change that really wasn't part of our regular bag of tricks, lack of a better term. And it's increasing demand on the services.
Armstrong highlighted the work and dedication of full-time and volunteer firefighters in the department.
The real bright stars in all of this in our service provision is our composite fire department. Our firefighters, full-time and volunteer, work tirelessly to ensure the mandate is achieved and ensure the fire protection services are done in the most efficient way. We are working with them, you know, since I've started in here last April. And really, I've learned that their top values are teamwork, accountability, and respect. And I believe accountability is equally as important to them. So we have a great department. They're passionate, they're empowered, and the full-time and volunteers are working together in a way that's very positive and exciting for the future.
Councillor Bill Martin showed his support for Armstrong in the new role.
I think the town of Napanee is in great hands with the team we have here, with both the chief and the deputy chief, Feeney, as well. And I think we're extremely lucky to have a man of such impeccable character as our fire chief.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to Local Journalism Initiative reporter Jack McCool from CJPE with an update on the new Prince Edward County Memorial Hospital.
Ground has broken and shovels are out at the site of the new Prince Edward County Memorial Hospital. Quinney Health held a virtual community update on the status of the hospital on Tuesday for members of the community to get an important update on the status of the new build and how it will serve our community.
I could not be more excited today to have the opportunity to welcome you to our first virtual community update. Although we've had some updates in other venues and forums over the years, most of those have really been about the build up to the approval of the hospital and starting to get it built. And now, with the excitement of having shovels in the ground and the building actually going up, this is an opportunity for us to give a really good update. The new Prince Edward County Memorial Hospital is going to be more than just a healthcare facility. It's going to be a beacon of what's possible when you think about innovation, meeting commitment. The hospital will also be an opportunity to meet the growing and diverse needs in the county. There are lots of things happening in the county. We have new populations, new citizens moving. We have populations that are aging. We have people of every background and age, and we have visitors who will be able to use the hospital.
That was the voice of Quinney Health's president and CEO, Stacy Daub, as she welcomed residents into the virtual community meeting. The bulk of the update centered around the construction process up to this point and what the finished product will ultimately look like and include. The building is set to become the very first hospital in North America that is made entirely out of mass timber. As well, another major component of the hospital build is sustainability. Jason Emery Groen, design director at HDR Architecture, led the audience through what that will ultimately look and feel like and what some of the key sustainable features will be.
You probably by now have heard about the Prince Edward County Memorial Hospital being the first all mass timber acute care hospital in North America. And so we thought we'd take a minute and talk about, in fact, what that's all about really here this afternoon. To really answer this, we have to kind of go back to first principles a little bit. We have to think about the purpose of the building. And I think Stacy expressed that really well. It is fundamentally to ensure that the members of the community, as well as the visitors of the area, can be cared for and supported by the staff that take all of their time here to make sure that that they do get better. And so ultimately to go from unhealthy to well. But what is really interesting with this project is that we were challenged by Quinty and by you, by the community, to maybe consider that it's not only for the people of the county that those need to get better, but perhaps even for the environment, the county, and even perhaps beyond. And so some of you online this afternoon may have heard some of us state that years ago, the Hippocratic Oath, the promise that doctors made, if you will, was to first do no harm. And in this case, we feel that this project is not only doing that, we hope, but extending it broadly to the entire planet. And so how do we actually go about constructing something like this, or even regular buildings? Well, obviously, as you may know well, we use a lot of concrete in buildings. In fact, hospitals are predominantly built out of concrete. They also use a lot of steel, and both of those materials take an incredible amount of energy to produce. And so in reality, when we were challenged to look at this, we have done buildings in mass timber, other forms of buildings. But up to today, or now, hospitals have never actually been fully built with mass timber. Often parts of them, the front entrance or the canopy, but not actually the entire building. So in this case, the equation here, if you will, is to bring everything together so that it's not just about the feel or the aesthetic, but it's really about doing something complete with the project. So Stacy mentioned, I believe, some recent media as far away as Australia. And of course, I don't think Australia would be talking about your front canopy if it was in wood. In fact, I probably can guarantee that. But the fact that this has never been done like this before in North America certainly has gotten a lot of attention. So with that, the next question is, well, how will it happen? And so when we look at the building, it obviously is all mass timber. That is undoubtedly a headline. But there is a lot more to the building. It actually includes solar panels on top. And to clarify, the solar panels cannot generate all the energy that this building needs. Building does require a fair amount of energy, but it will certainly help mitigate the total energy load. Beyond that, we have areas of green roofs, which help reduce the amount of water that drops right into the drainage system right away. And it also acts to be able to create pollinators and other elements within the environment. The building is going to be EV ready for parking. So those are electric vehicles, making sure that we can actually maybe use a bit of that solar power for other things. And something that is really quite incredible, and I literally do call this magic, a geothermal energy system. So that is actually what's happening right now. There's a lot of wells being drilled on site, and those geothermal wells are going to be able to provide a significant amount more energy than they actually consume to be able to operate. So literally magic. And give or take, the numbers are for one unit of energy, we expect probably 3 to 4 units of heat or cooling and process load for the building itself, which is pretty incredible. That is why I call it magic. And then, of course, operable windows. You would think that's obvious. However, not that common in current hospitals. And so here, Quinty made the choice to make sure that patients really truly could connect to the out-of-doors if they felt the need to. And of course, a robust building envelope. What to building today isn't a good one without that. There are a lot of details that involve that, but making sure that the building is tight and sound. And then, of course, the landscaping, being biodiverse in terms of the approach, and there are many other facets that relate to that as well. And then the stormwater, I mentioned that, being able to make sure that the site holds some of the water back in the event of a storm in a good way, in a productive way, such that it can release that back out to the adjacent stream and other areas. Because the building, this hospital, is in the watershed and in the freshwater or drinking water catchment of Picton as well. And ultimately, that it's climate resiliency proofed. And what that really means is that we aren't designing the building for today, we're designing for future climates. We already know what some of those temperatures are going to shift towards. So we're making sure that the building is taking all of that into account.
The meeting also saw the announcement of an in-house CT scanner so that important diagnostics can take place in Prince Edward County rather than being outsourced to other medical institutes. The community update also informed residents of Prince Edward County about the Back the Build campaign by the Prince Edward County Memorial Hospital Foundation. The foundation's executive director, Shannon Kuhl, provided those in attendance with the updated funding numbers.
I am pleased to report that with the help of our community partners and all of our donors, we've raised just over $24 million towards our $30 million goal.
Quinney Health said that they plan to hold these community updates twice a year until the completion of the new hospital. The next session is set to take place in September and will include lots of information regarding the staffing and inner workings of the hospital. For the Local Journalism Initiative, FrequencyNews.ca and 99.3 County FM, I'm Jack McCool, filling in for Brenda Little.
Thank you to Jack McCool for that story. Over now to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFW and Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the School Infrastructure Fund in Northumberland County.
Nonprofit groups, First Nations, and other community organizations are encouraged to apply to the United Way Northumberland for grants to increase school food production. Projects considered for the School Food Infrastructure Fund include enhancing access to food, increasing food production, equipment, and storage. United Way Northumberland Executive Director Alicia Van Dyne says this program is to ensure students are properly nourished for the classroom.
We're really excited about this new funding opportunity. The Student Food Infrastructure Grant Program is meant for anyone who is doing any nutrition programs within their school. And I think of breakfast clubs or after-school programming, things where there is an element of nutrition. And this fund is set up to help build capacity. And in that capacity, we're asking organizations to take a look at their infrastructure needs.
And so just define infrastructure, you're talking like fridges, stoves, kitchen equipment.
So eligible costs fall into a few different categories. There's a food production category, which could be that they maybe want to establish a community garden within the school. It could be anything related to transforming or processing or the preparation of food. So that's any type of essential cooking equipment. You know, think of, as you mentioned, ovens, steamers, small kitchen appliances, any washing equipment. The other category is refrigeration and storage of food. So obviously freezers, any type of storage racks, and transportation, of course, too. So there's a little bit of something in there for everyone, depending on what the need is within their school environment.
Now, how do you see this benefiting schools in terms of not only food, but I guess knowledge or education of food?
You know, I think everyone can agree that children learn better when they have nutrition, and certainly help them to perform better. You know, and for some students who may be living in a home that's struggling, it may be an opportunity for them to just provide that little bit of extra. And I think that that's the wonderful thing about any of the school nutrition programs that are happening. It's about access, and it's open to everyone.
So why is the United Way getting involved in this program?
So the United Way has a long tradition of relating to programs within food security, and it really ties into our Northumberland Eats 2.0 program. Initially, the United Way got involved in a voucher program, and as COVID relief funding ended, there was a will, and certainly we saw a need for more food security programs, and we adapted that program to be into this micro-grant stage. So over the last few months, we were able to provide not only some small grants to local food banks, but also to folks who were working in the communal meal program. Could be through a church, it could be through a local organization. We placed dollars across Northumberland County. So the movement into student nutrition program is really about increasing Northumberland needs and our approach in our food insecurity policies.
So what research, I guess, have you conducted or indicates that this program is needed in Northumberland?
You know, a lot of our schools have aging infrastructure. And as part of our research with Community Matters, student nutrition needs were identified by our local community members as an area of interest that they wanted the United Way to be a part of.
So then how do I apply if I'm interested in, what's the deadline?
The deadline is March the 19th. Our portal is open on our website under the community funding envelope on our page. If you go to what we do, and it'll be listing as a funding programs, it's listed right at the top of that funding page. There is a portal to click on. There's also a full eligibility requirements that are there to be able to apply, and a guide to help every organization that would like to apply for those dollars. You know, we're really excited about this. It's the first time that we have worked together with other United Ways. There will be spreading some dollars across the province in very rural and remote areas. We're very excited to be working together with our sister agencies to do great work in our communities. And I just would also like to point out that any of the grant applications that are made in Northumberland County, decisions are made here in Northumberland. So although we are working together, all decisions are made locally.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, March 6th, we're going to see a daytime high of 1 degree with a 60% chance of flurries or rain showers, dropping down to minus 8 overnight. Friday, March 7th, daytime high of 1 degree with a mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to minus 6 overnight. Moving into the weekend now. Saturday, March 8th, daytime high of minus 1 with a mix of sun and cloud. Sunday, March 9th, going to be slightly warmer, just above zero, with a daytime high of 1 in that mix of sun and cloud. And then Monday, March 10th, we're going to see a daytime high of 4 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.